Please be seated. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think that even I can claim to be the Prime Minister. I'm only here to introduce him. The Romanus Lecture is, of course, the great public event of the university, so much so, indeed, that people throng outside the building to help us go forward and to participate. It is a very great privilege for us that the Prime Minister has agreed to give the Romanus Lecture. I will not indulge in a long introduction. You've come to hear him, not me. So let me just say that it is a great pleasure indeed for us. Thank you for coming.
I'd come across an Oxford customer I hadn't encountered before. Can I say it's an immense pleasure to be with you here this evening and to have these pleasant background noises in the back there. I was actually reminded when I saw the demonstrators that there were occasions when I was a student at Oxford that I used to go on the old demo. And I recall one particular occasion. We used to protest at the time. I was just saying this to Roy and his colleagues. We used to protest at the time about the absence of a students' union, a central students' union. And we used to march through the streets of Oxford, shouting, you know, when do we want the students' union? We want it now, etc. And we marched through one day, and I think it was actually Hugh Trevor Roper at the time, who was quoted in one of the Oxford papers as saying that not merely did he disagree with our campaign, but we were singularly badly dressed in smelly old jumpers. So ever afterwards, we used to march through the streets of Oxford saying, when do we want the students' union? We want it now. What are we wearing, smelly old jumpers? And, well, there you are. There's probably a future prime minister out there. On Can't say I noticed them, though. It is, of course, hazardous for a prime minister to speak in Oxford on the subject of education. However, I'm not in search of an honorary degree, and I could, well, not yet anyway, but I could hardly decline when Roy pointed out to me that the first Romanus lecture was given by Mr. Gladstone, who also took education as his theme, I may say. On closer investigation in Roy's superb biography of Gladstone, I discovered that Gladstone gave the lecture when he had just become Prime Minister for the fourth time at the age of 82. So the thought crossed my mind that I should seek a postponement until the year 2034. This idea didn't linger long, you'll be relieved to hear. My title this evening is The Learning Habit, and I want to explain what the government is seeking to achieve in its programme of education reform, and how, as a nation in the 21st century, we can achieve a learning habit across society, a nation, if you like, hooked on learning, not just as young people, but throughout all of our lives. I would like, first of all, to set the context of this policy and the overall government policy. When we took office, we could look at some areas of real improvement over the previous 20 years. For example, industrial competitiveness, curbing excessive trade union power. But some things had got worse. Economic management was poor, with two deep recessions in two decades. There was chronic instability, boom and bust in the economic cycle. The borrowing requirement we inherited was some £28 billion. National debt had doubled at the upstage of the cycle, an unsustainable position. Investment in infrastructure and public services was declining as a proportion of national income. Indeed, the share of national income spent on education was falling sharply. Unemployment was set to rise, pushing up social security spending, which had already risen by some 4% in real terms over the last parliament, that's 92 to 97, a higher rate than spending on schools and hospitals and transport. And our view was that these things were all integrally linked. Economic instability meant that business failed to invest. Rising unemployment and social exclusion increased unproductive spending and crowded out investment in the future. A lack of investment harmed competitiveness and so on. So when we came to office, we had to decide what our priorities were and we had to tackle them. We first had to put the economy on a sound footing. The new system of economic management, Bank of England independence plus the new fiscal rules, is now in place. It is too soon to claim that we have definitely beaten the old boom and bust problem, but we have come through a downturn without a recession for the first time in decades. Inflation and interest rates are at historic lows. Partially through this and partially through measures like the New Deal and the working families tax credit that helps low-income families into work, unemployment is falling. Youth unemployment has actually halved, and we now have Britain's highest ever level of employment. As a result of that, social security spending, at least on social and economic failure, is falling. After two rather tight years, as I'm sure you know, of public spending, something incidentally, however, that is a promise kept, not a promise broken, since that's what we said we would have to do, we are now in a period of a steady rise in the proportion of national income spent on education and health in particular. By the end of this parliament, both will be higher, and with continuing sound economic management, we can then plan substantial investment in the 3 years after that. With that investment will then come essential reform. Money for modernisation is what we said, and it's what we will deliver. So that is the context in which education policy is set. And we said before the election, and we mean, that our number one priority for investment is education. And I want to explain, again, the context in which I make this lecture to you this evening. The reason why I believe that education is more important today than ever before as a priority for government is this. In the 21st century, the battle that has dominated politics in this century between, if you like, economic policy on the one hand and social policy on the other, I think will end. The old dispute between those who on the one hand favour growth and prosperity and those who favour social justice and compassion on the other is over. And this is what I believe is the reason for this phenomenon. The liberation of human potential for all the people, not just a few, is in today's world the key both to economic and social progress today. In economic terms, human capital, certainly for a country like this, is the nation's biggest resource. Brain power, skills, flexibility, rather than cheap manual labour, are the key to competitiveness and productivity. But in social terms also, the old basis of civic society, built around deference and hierarchy very often, will not do. Today's people will accept citizenship, but on nothing less than equal terms, opportunity to all, responsibility from all. That, if you like, is the new social contract that most of our people would acknowledge. So education today is critical to both the economic and the social. And the implications of this, therefore, are absolutely profound for government policy and for the future of the nation. For us as a whole, it means shifting from a low-skill average to a high-skill average, or, as I put it, excellence for the many, not just the few. The wider purpose, then, of schools also must change in a society where rights and duties need to be justified and accepted, not inherited and imposed. Yet most important of all is the implication for the type of education we need. On the one hand, we will need universal competence in the basic skills, including the new information technologies. On the other, we need diversity with excellence, an education meeting the full range of individual needs beyond the basics, both the innate abilities, too often neglected at present, and the specific training and skills suited to people's aptitudes, which requires a far more flexible system of secondary and post-16 education. Now, Universal competence in the basics, therefore, diversity with excellence beyond, meeting the needs of each individual, and then, if you like, a learning habit, if you want to call it that, spanning society at all ages. Now, I believe it is possible to achieve a world-class education system which meets these objectives. Later, I will explain how. But if we are to achieve it, we can only do so if we have a massive sense of national purpose behind us as a country. If we really do make it, over a period of time, the priority for our government and indeed for our country. To grasp that future, we need to understand the past and the present. As a country, as we can see here, we value continuity as much as change, and we're often right to do so. In education, we can be very justly proud of parts of our inheritance, a tradition of scholarship, discovery, and creativity second to none, some of the best universities in the world, many excellent schools, many dedicated teachers. But when it comes to an assessment of how our education system has worked over a period of time for the broad majority of the people, we need, with honesty and frankness, to confront our past, not continue it. And we must understand where we went wrong, why we reached the end of the first century of universal state education with nearly one in four adults lacking basic literacy, the highest proportion in Europe except in Poland and Ireland, ranking 25th in international assessments for maths among 13-year-olds, with poor average school standards, widespread indifference to achievement, despite the best efforts of so many schools and teachers. Now, cultural forces have played a part. So too, the structure of an economy built on mass manual labour with little premium on higher skills in its major industries and too little innovation and enterprise. These themes are well rehearsed by historians and economists, but I want to highlight another factor too little emphasised, but I believe utterly critical, and that is, frankly, political indifference and lack of leadership. And this too has deep roots. For most of the last 150 years, mass education has been of at best fitful concern to Britain's political leaders, left and right. In consequence, central government has taken scant interest in standards and investment, too often dismissing as a matter of local concern and regulation what was in truth a chronic failure of national leadership and national responsibility. Mr. Gladstone, indeed, if Roy will forgive me, is a telling case, and I do not deny for a moment that he was one of our greatest prime ministers, but not as an educational reformer. At a time when leading continental states, Germany in particular, were forging ahead in primary and technical education, Gladstone's Liberal governments would go no further than to allow local ratepayers to set up primary schools if they so wished. Gladstone rejected compulsory schooling as, quotes, adverse to the national character, opposed the abolition of fees in primary schools, and was agitated that even at its then paltry levels, state education spending would explode unless reined in. And characteristically, that first Romanus lecture delivered in 1892, by when Britain's educational failings were pretty apparent, was an erudite account of the history and strength of the ancient universities, particularly Oxford and Cambridge, but not a great deal of concern about the world beyond. Now, I'm not expecting, as it were, Edison to have invented the internet, if that's the right way to put it, but Britain's weakness in mass education was in fact the subject of sustained commentary among the Victorians by royal commissions and others, as it has been ever since. And yet, if you measure that, which was almost part of a consensus, against the political will to lead and to act, it was rarely present and never sufficient. When in 1839 Lord Melbourne's government made the first state grant for schools, equivalent, I may say, to a tiny fraction of what Prussia was then spending, the minister responsible told Parliament that English education was very inferior to that of Northern Europe, and the want of education and the deficiency of the means of popular instruction are almost universally admitted. Yet, it was another 30 years before the state took direct responsibility for providing primary schools, and fully 50 years before primary schooling was free and compulsory. Average standards, in fact, remained very low. The slow growth of secondary education is an equally sorry tale. By the 1880s, there was widespread agreement that government had to act. 2 decades followed of ineffective half-measures and haggling about who would do it and pay for it. Finally came a ministerial admission that the situation was critical and that something had to be done, this time from Arthur Balfour, the only Prime Minister before Jim Callaghan to take much interest in state schooling, to be fair. And this is what Balfour said, introducing his 1902 education bill. From the example of America or Germany or France, he said, or any other country which has devoted itself to educational problems, I am forced to the conclusion that ours is the most antiquated, the most ineffectual, and the most wasteful method yet invented for providing a national education. So it's not a great write-up. Yet what happened? 35 years later, on the eve of the Second World War, not even 4 in 10 14-year-olds were attending secondary school. At the end of the war, of course, then came a step forward with the Butler Act of 1944. But it was a half step at best, because universal secondary education came with the 11 plus, and that did consign a majority of teenagers to secondary modern schools, which were soon a byword for not being in the front stream of success. So too with the promise of a school leaving age of 16, not honored for yet another 30 years, because schools were too low a spending priority, to put it bluntly, for Tory and Labour governments alike. So there was, I think, a case there for saying there was national indifference and a lack of leadership. And it was revealed in so many other ways too, in poor support and recognition for the teaching profession, in the buck passing between central and local government on major issues of policy and investment, in stark contrast, I think it's worth saying, to health, where under Nye Bevan, the post-war Labour government took a decisive lead and really made a huge step forward for the country, and in the low status of the education ministry for most of its history, and its semi-detached status, indeed, within the education world itself. I regret to say it was Labour's Reg Prentice, although I think he wasn't always ours, who had this to say of his 15 months as education secretary in the mid-1970s. He said, "We had very little education policy when I was there, and what there was meant very little to me." It's a depressing but revealing statement. Imagine an ex-chancellor writing of his time at the Treasury, "We had very little economic policy, and what little there was meant very little to me." He would never say that. Even if it was true, they wouldn't dare to admit it. In retrospect, the mid-1970s marked the turning point, and I think it's worth paying tribute to Jim Callaghan, who famously came to Oxford to say so. Jim Callaghan knew vividly from his own experience both the power of education and the price of missed opportunities. And his 1976 Ruskin speech began with Tawney's words, "The endowments of our children are the most precious of the natural resources of the community." So why, he asked, was industry complaining that recruits from schools sometimes do not have the basic tools to do the job? Why was there no national curriculum? What should be done about teaching practices, which seem to produce excellent results when they are in well-qualified hands, but are much more dubious when they are not? What was, he asked, the proper way of monitoring the use of resources to maintain a proper national standard of performance? Read today, in a sense, the speech is remarkably tame. The sensation was caused not so much by what he said, but the fact that he was saying it. For the first time ever, a Prime Minister was placing national school standards high on the political agenda and suggesting, what's more, that government had some responsibility to take a firm lead and proper responsibility. It is then taken another couple of decades for this really to happen. I readily acknowledge that the last government moved some way forward in its later years, establishing a national curriculum, introducing overdue reforms such as the GCSE, national testing, regular school inspections. However, few would claim that education was among the last government's key priorities. We have inherited, as a new government, a situation all too little changed from Jim Callaghan's day. Average performance far too low, inadequate momentum to improve it, and an integral part of the problem, an inadequate system of accountability and responsibility from the centre, from government, outwards. So let me say where I stand. It is central to my conception of politics in an age where the endowments of our children, as Tawney called them, are literally, not just rhetorically, the most precious of the natural resources of the community. It is right that government should give proper leadership and take proper responsibility for educational standards in this country. Not to do so in this modern world is as great a dereliction of the national interest as failing to maintain an adequate defence or an adequate foreign policy. So what does it mean for government then? If we agree that we must take this proper leadership and responsibility, what does that actually mean in practical terms? I believe it means three things principally, and I don't just mean education, education, and education. Or as someone said after my recent news the other day, education, 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 and education. First, government must take national responsibility for investment in raising standards and place the imperative for this at the top of the political agenda. In doing so, our intervention should be in inverse proportion to success, full accountability, decisive action to tackle failure, but trust and reward for successful leaders. Second, government itself must set clear goals and targets. I will set out what I believe to be our fundamental goal, an education system combining diversity with excellence, high standards for everyone in the basics in primary school as a platform for an education liberating the talent and capacity of each individual. For our primary schools, this means investment in a broader curriculum and set of opportunities as we achieve near universal competence in the basics. But actually, the most radical implications are for our secondary schools, where we need to abandon once and for all a mindset which views only two broad options, an entire system based on selection with some kind of 11 plus on the one hand, or on the other, standardized, monolithic comprehensives offering a standardized, monolithic provision for pupils whose needs are highly diverse and individual. We need diversity with excellence to be the hallmark of the secondary system, rejecting completely the notion of a comprehensive education, treating different provision for different individuals as somehow a betrayal of their equal worth. In the modern world, diversity with excellence, schools with distinct centres of excellence, providing radically different opportunities and provision for pupils with different needs, is, in my view, the only viable future for our secondary schools, as I shall say in a moment. And I think this is increasingly recognised, indeed, in the secondary sector. And our third task is to be equally robust and ambitious about opportunities beyond 16. How to abolish, once and for all, the notion of an education leaving age of 16. But equally, how to combine diversity with excellence in our colleges and universities, where a wide variety of quality provision focused on individual needs is as necessary as it is in secondary schools. So let me take these in turn. First, national responsibility for investment in raising standards. As a government, we've probably set out more boldly, certainly in greater detail, than any of our predecessors, our objectives in education and the investment required to meet them. And when that is done, of course, we are then bound by those targets and objectives. It's what we call in politics a high-risk, high-gain strategy. If you meet the objectives and targets, that's great. If you don't, you've got a problem. We said that the nation's key priority was early education, and we shaped our programme accordingly. So under five provision is to be given so that children start school ready to learn. Primary school classes with no classes of more than 30 in the infant years. Far better and more focused teaching in the key skills of numeracy and literacy. We've done as we have promised. A nursery place for every four-year-old whose parents want one. A large increase in places for three-year-olds. On target next year virtually to eliminate classes of more than 30 for 5, 6 and 7 year olds, and there has been a significant advance in literacy and numeracy. We said also that we would make a step change in investment in school buildings and infrastructure, too much of which is in a pretty deplorable state after decades of neglect. And again, we have tried to do as we've promised there. Capital spending on schools will double in real terms in the course of this Parliament. It's a pretty big increase. More than 10,000 schools have already been upgraded, We said we would tackle failing schools and local education authorities. We are doing so. Failing education authority services are being contracted out, and both the number of failing schools and the time taken to turn them round is for the first time in a long time actually falling today, not rising. We also said we would reform student finance in an equitable way to improve the funding of universities after a decade of serious erosion and to allow for further expansion in student numbers. Not a universally popular reform, as you can hear. But we've done so with a reform which actually does take full account of each family's circumstances, a third of students paying no fees at all, a third paying a reduced fee, only a third paying the £1,025, which itself represents only a quarter of the average cost of a university course. Through this reform, however, and this is the important thing, we have actually been able to increase university funding in real terms. So it's not taking money out of the system, there's actually more money going in the system, but it allows us to get rid of the old cap on student numbers, expand student numbers, and separately, of course, in partnership with the Wellcome Trust, we've increased funding for university research and infrastructure by some £1.4 billion, and that money is starting to kick in now. We also said we would increase education spending as a share of national income over the course of this Parliament. We are on course to do that too. Given the strong economy, this is generating a very significant rise in education spending, an increase of at least 16% in real terms over this year and the next two. But I accept the first 2 years have been very tough for the reasons that I've given. And that's meant that for many schools, even with the spending coming on this year, they need the further years of consistent, sustained funding in order to get themselves on the right footing. So in saying this, I'm not simply saying all the things that the government has done. I'm spelling out what I mean by national responsibility for investment in raising standards and enhancing opportunities. And I know, too, that this is only the first step. I think if I'm realistic about this, you know, there are going to be huge amounts still to do in universities as elsewhere. And there will be no less demanding targets and the investment to back them up in our programme for the next Parliament. Education, I should make it clear, will continue to have the first call on public resources in return, though, for the step change in standards that we need. But national leadership is not just about providing the resources. It is also about guaranteeing that they're used for their purpose, which is to modernise and raise standards. And this, if you like, is what we as a political party are reaching for, that we make that investment in the public services, but we use it at the same time to drive through the lift in standards that we believe we need. And that means that government cannot repeat the error of the past and remain indifferent on the sidelines if indeed there are failures that we desperately and urgently need to address. Consider the nation's most basic educational objective of all, ensuring that all our young people are literate and numerate. Until the introduction of national tests for 11-year-olds 4 years ago and the publication of the results, there was no means of parents knowing the success of primary schools, school by school, in getting children up to the standard in English and maths, let alone what the national picture was. And when we actually got those figures and results, the national picture was deeply shocking. In 1996, just before we came to office, 43% of 11-year-olds were well below standard in English, 46% below standard in maths. A child who cannot read, cannot learn. Nearly half of pupils were going on to secondary school without the basic tools to be able to learn after 6 years of full-time schooling. And that was the national picture, but in a large number of primary schools and some entire local education authorities, most of the pupils were reaching 11 without the basic literacy and numeracy skills. What chance can a learning society have built on that shameful foundation? And should we have been surprised then that levels of disaffection and dropout were so high at secondary level, giving us one of the lowest staying on rates at 16 in the developed world? And at this point, if you like, the rather abstract arguments about whether it's right the government intervenes or it doesn't dissolve. Ensuring that children leave primary school with the basic tools of literacy and numeracy is the most fundamental task of the education system. It was not happening, so we acted. And one of David Blunkett's first acts as Education Secretary was to set up a standards and effectiveness unit within the Department of Education and Employment, and that developed what we called literacy and numeracy strategies for teachers and schools based on best practice. A nationally determined, locally delivered program of teacher training followed, with special help for schools with the lowest test results, all supported by national investment. New literacy and numeracy lessons were introduced on a national model. National targets were set. 80% of 11-year-olds to be up to standard literacy by 2002, 75% in numeracy, and translated then into targets for each individual school by local authorities. National investment to reduce all early year classes to below 30 was also instituted because of the evidence that it was in those years that smaller class sizes really mattered. Taken together, it was given a budget of more than £1 billion, that's of new money, to implement the programme and generate a step change in primary standards. 2 years later, large classes in the early years have almost been eliminated. Teachers and parents now, at least, not to begin with, overwhelmingly support the literacy and numeracy lessons in schools, and test results have improved sharply. This year, we reached for the first time 70% in literacy, 69% in numeracy, and it is in the full glare of local and national attention. The feverish expectations surrounding the publication of this year's test results reminded me of what used to accompany the balance of payments figures in the old days, so great is the political immediate interest now in school standards. And I'm pleased to say that David Blunkett has taken full responsibility for these national targets being met. And he looks set to be around for a good while yet. So I went into that in some detail, not, I suppose, because there'll be much use to anyone here preparing for finals, but because they demonstrate what I mean by the government analysing, seeing that a problem exists, and being prepared to give proper leadership and taking proper responsibility. So as a government, we acknowledge our duty on behalf of parents and children to secure acceptable minimum standards in schools, all schools, something that should have been done decades ago. If schools are to succeed, of course they also need the maximum resources available. And that's why we are pressing local education authorities so hard to delegate more to the front line and not to hold money back in bureaucracy or an outdated belief that except in cases of failure, they know better how to spend money than do the head teachers in charge. Across the education system, where standards are being met, our approach is one of high autonomy in return for full accountability, allowing maximum freedom to schools for the successful. In the case of higher education, I know that universities are not always over the moon about existing accountability arrangements. Acronyms like RAE and TQA and QAA don't seem to get much of a cheer in audiences like this, but let me say that we take seriously the principle of intervention in inverse proportion to success, which is why the future of teaching quality assessments in particular is being reviewed to keep red tape to an absolute minimum. So where we need to intervene, we are actually doing so on the basis of very clear programmes with targets that the government then publicly commits itself to, so that if we fail to meet those targets, the responsibility is very clear. And that brings me to my second theme, which is diversity with excellence. The starting point is clear enough. Every child must be competent in basic skills. 80% in literacy, 75% in numeracy will be a major step forward, but it's not enough. Beyond 2002, a further intense national effort will be required to get as close to 100%, which should be our ambition ultimately, as we possibly can. Tackling adult basic skills is also vital, and David Blunkett intends radical action to follow the Moser Report's findings on the acute challenge we face in this area. It's equally clear also that the concept of basic skills can no longer be restricted to literacy and numeracy amongst 11-year-olds. Proficiency in information technology has become a basic skill even for a prime minister. As you know, a short time ago I went, I went on my very first computer course in, well, the young people here will think this is completely crazy thing to be doing because everyone should have these skills already, but I didn't. And I decided to go on this course in my constituency. So I went along and sat down with everyone, just an ordinary group of people in this computer course in the constituency. It was actually marvelously instructive about the new world in which we live. It certainly opened up a new world for me. And I sat in this room with some people who were unemployed, some people were old age pensioners, some people who were women whose children were growing up and therefore they decided to return to work. But my point is, you know, I've been preaching so long about everyone acquiring these skills, I thought I should go and acquire them myself. The only difficulty came in the course of this course that stretched over several hours. They set us tests along the way to see how we did. And about halfway through the course, the guy who was sitting next to me seemed to get a bit agitated, nervous, and I said to him, there's no need to be nervous. I said, you're nervous because I'm Prime Minister. He said, no, I'm not nervous about that at all. He said, it's just that we've been having all these tests, and he said, and I've been beating you in all of them. He said, I'm unemployed and you're Prime Minister. So, you know, we've all got to come to terms with this new learning age, some of us quicker and better than others. But it is true. I mean, every single person operating in business in this field tells me, and I believe, I can at least see the intellectual concept of I can't always deliver it practically myself. It is going to transform, literally, the whole of our commerce, our industry, our way of life, our communications, probably our leisure activities as well. And after 500 years, if you like, of just sort of teachers and books as the way to learn, we are suddenly going to have a continuous stream of new technologies enhancing the learning process. Someone told me on my way here that the Encyclopedia Britannica had now put the whole of its thing on the, you know, on the internet. And of course, this is, you know, kids are going to be learning in a completely different way, but all of us are going to be learning in a completely different way. Leading edge schools are already deploying composition programs in music, digital cameras and art, simulation software and design and technology and science, spreadsheets and mathematics and in business studies, the internet across the curriculum and interactive programs and languages and many other subjects. ICT is permeating every school and the entire curriculum. We are at the beginning of the end of an era of education, an era where the issue for the most part was how to achieve the maximum amount of learning within limited teaching resources. Entering the 21st century with the new technology, our goal is to become, if you like, learning bound rather than teacher bound. This is not to replace teachers, but to enhance and supplement them in and out of school with the vast interactive resources of ICT. Let me explain what I mean by that. It's been estimated that the full cost of one school teacher hour is £50, and rightly for our teachers it is rising. But the full cost of one school ICT hour is about 75p and dropping at 20% a year, at the same time as the inherent capability of the technology is rising. And as it rises, in the hands of skilled teachers, as learning managers, so does the capacity for ICT to personalise learning, to provide the tailored support for different aptitudes and needs, which is critical to the future. And that's one of the most exciting and important implications of ICT. The transformation ahead may actually be as significant as the rise of organised schooling itself. And as I say, not just for young people, but for all people. And this time, Britain must and has to be, and will be, I believe, an international leader. Our position is strong. We already have one of the most ICT-literate school-leaving population in the developed world. In the National Grid for Learning and the University of Industry, we have a strategy and investment program to keep us there, spreading ICT learning far beyond the school-age population. With continued investment, not least in research and development and the right commercial partnerships, we can lead in the application of this information technology to all areas of the curriculum, and it will be one of our highest priorities as a government. So literacy, numeracy, and the ability to use ICT are the three key skills which every school and college leaver requires, and which every adult should have the means of mastering and updating, whether in the workplace, at home, in college, or through the new technology itself. But no one argues that these things are an end in themselves, or that primary schools should concentrate on them at the expense of all else. Our position has always been clear. To tackle the crisis we faced in school literacy and numeracy, basic skills had to become the overriding priority of primary schools. And of course, we also, through the government programme that we've initiated in the past 2 years, are wiring up all the schools, primary and secondary, to the new technology right round the country at the moment with a massive programme of investment behind it. But we believe they should continue to be focused in primary schools on the basics until the overwhelming majority of pupils are achieving the competence needed for their age as a matter of course. Secondary schools also need to pay proper attention to literacy and numeracy for those students who are below standard. Once we have achieved excellence in basic skills, however, then we need a proper diversity of opportunities beyond that, so that the aptitudes and abilities of every individual are developed to the full. Because education is for life, not just for jobs. I make no excuse for placing literacy and numeracy at its core. They too are for life, not just for jobs. And those who lack them, young or old, are in a sense handicapped socially as much as economically. But as we succeed in reaching the standard needed in these key skills, school by school, we will then be able to pay increasing attention and make also an increasing investment in the broader curriculum and range of opportunities for our young people. Singapore, to take an example, with academic results among the highest in the world, recently appointed a commission to report on education for them for the 21st century. And it was very interesting reading. They concluded that education needed to go beyond skill acquisition, and I quote, to instill qualities such as curiosity, creativity, enterprise, leadership, teamwork, and perseverance, developing young people in the moral, social, physical, and aesthetic domains. That, I think, is a pretty good ambition for any education system. And that's our ambition too. Many schools already achieve a great deal in these areas, and year by year, for example, with the recent drive to improve citizenship education in our schools, we move forward. But there is a vast amount more to be done, both in primary schools and still more for secondary schools, where the modernisation of the comprehensive principle is in its early stages. Let me start again with a few concrete examples at primary level. Modern languages. English may be the new lingua franca, a competitive advantage for us as a nation, not least in education. But the competitive advantage for us as individuals is the capacity to make our way as freely as possible through the new Europe and the wider world. Everyone knows that with languages, the earlier you start, the easier they are. The national curriculum rightly makes a modern language compulsory from the beginning of secondary school, but many children gain a valuable head start earlier. Some primary schools already do excellent work in this area, and the language teaching from the age of 7 or 8 is actually almost universal in independent schools once competence in the basics has been achieved. I mean, I say to my children and I'd say to any other young people, actually learning languages and getting to grips with languages at an early stage, there really is no more valuable thing for you throughout the course of your life. And it's one of these things that gives pleasure as well as advantage in the labour market. I was very fortunate after university, in fact, to go and work in France for a time and learn to speak the language a little bit better. But it is my, in a sense, my regret that I didn't take the language instruction I got at school more seriously. And I still think our school system is not geared up with nearly the same seriousness on languages as those in many of our competitor countries. So at all schools, moving towards universal competence in literacy and numeracy, the scope for more language teaching in the later primary years, as that happens in literacy and numeracy and we get universal competence there, that scope for more language teaching is something we are seriously considering. So too with music and sport. And David Blunkett has done a great deal to promote sport and music in our schools, including tough action to prevent the sale of sports fields, new funding for local music provision, new specialist secondary schools for sports and arts. Yet as we succeed with literacy and numeracy, more can be done. Too many schools that I visit, have no sports facilities, let alone playing fields and organized games. Too many children lack the chance to learn a musical instrument or to develop talent in other branches of the arts. Opportunities are far too unevenly spread, particularly for those who've so little to start with. There is no single blueprint for improvement, but music, art, sport, and languages all have a part to play in school and beyond. And the idea of a 9 to 3:30 Monday to Friday school with no after-school or holiday activities has just got to become a thing of the past. Once we've got, then, those basics right, we develop the skills and talents of all our young people to the full. This requires opportunities for all, reflecting the equal worth of all. And it is not a question of equal provision for all, let alone, as some on the right allege, of prizes for all simply for taking part. It's a question of asking ourselves some basic issues and the questions relating to them about how much opportunity our children really have. How many children sit in schools today with low ambitions but with huge reserves of talent that have never been unearthed? Thousands of them, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of them. A sports enthusiast at a school with no playing fields, no competitive sports, no place to practice. A child with a talent for music, but no chance to learn a musical instrument or go to a concert. A would-be actor with no drama club or production to take part in. A potential leader with no responsibility. All those for whom the chance to excel, or even experience has never been given. Or those who go to school where everything stops at 3:30 and there are none of the organized activities and instruction which the more fortunate take for granted. How many thousands and thousands of pupils right round the country are in that condition? And as a nation, we have done superbly over generations for a small number. At the top, the standards we achieve and the emphasis we place on education beyond the classroom are internationally renowned. The pastoral dimension, sport, music, voluntary service in the community. But we need to make them nationally renowned too, by making them available to all. That's what I mean by equal worth, a one-nation society in which all citizens have the same rights and the same responsibilities. They're not going to be the same people, and they will have different abilities, but they should have at least the same life chances. Our goal is therefore high standards, realism and rigour in ensuring that young people pursue courses that suit them, but no ceilings to ambition or impediments to its realisation. So, we summarise the picture. Nationwide nursery provision, which prepares all children to learn at primary school. Primary schools which achieve universal competence in the basics. As this is achieved, a broader range of opportunities and skills, starting in primary, leading through to secondary, so that children have an equal chance to develop their aptitudes to the full. Proper emphasis on moral and social education throughout. Now that brings me to secondary schools, where the challenge is, if you like, even greater still to fulfill the potential of each individual pupil. To move forward here, I believe we need to confront our past in secondary education and to understand what went wrong here in particular. Comprehensive schools were devised as a way of radically improving a system which consigned 80% of children to a second-class education and second-class jobs thereafter. And it was a reaction to an undoubted injustice. The injustice of determining a child's ability and potential at the age of 11, and in effect, whatever the intention, branding them a success or failure. And few people now want to return to that system for the whole nation. But most people recognise that children do indeed have different abilities and often different aptitudes in different subjects. What is more, simply proclaiming that we have a comprehensive system is of no use if, in fact, there are vast disparities in the quality of one comprehensive against another. That is why this government is undertaking, in effect, a radical modernisation of the comprehensive system. We want to replace, and are replacing, the one-size-fits-all comprehensive concept with a massive extension of diversity within the system, on the basis of high standards for all in basic skills as the platform for excellence. That's why we are pushing forward so strongly with specialist schools, Specialist schools build on the national curriculum to develop areas of specialist excellence within comprehensives, whether technology, sport, the arts, or modern languages. They have business and community sponsorship. Setting in subjects is also being encouraged. New programmes of pupil support are being developed, promoting the needs of gifted and talented pupils. Taking welfare workers directly into schools, providing head teachers with better tools to tackle disaffection and barriers to learning on an individual basis. And there is much, much further to go in all these areas. This is, after all, only common sense. Children do indeed have different abilities. To admit this is not elitist, but necessary if we are to build an education system around the equal worth of each individual child. Universities, too, have a part to play, particularly in raising aspirations and helping schools make appropriate provision for their more able pupils. Last week, I launched a university summer school programme for 5,000 pupils from schools in the 6 largest cities. And I'm glad that Oxford is one of the universities involved, and I was delighted to meet a group of Oxford students pioneering an access scheme who came to the launch at a North London comprehensive. And some of them had attended inner-city London comprehensives. They'd had a struggle to get to Oxford, but they had done. And you've got no idea of those young people going back into those schools and saying, look, I did it, I managed to get there, what an effect that had on those other pupils, some of whom had spoken quite frankly to me about believing they never had a chance of going to university, no matter somewhere like Oxford. So we need a step change in the quantity and quality of relationships between schools and universities, alongside improved links between schools and employers. And we need to focus on those special abilities of each individual child. We also need diversity with excellence in the provision of new schools. In the last 2 years, Muslim and other groups have received state funding for new schools, providing education for their faith communities, building on our long tradition of church schools. There is room for greater diversity in the provision of new schools at secondary level too, not only for those with a religious motivation, but for those with other distinct missions, particularly centres of excellence in the mainstream areas of the curriculum. So there's a lot more that we can do to develop diversity within a modernised comprehensive system. Our ambitions are similarly high for post-16 education. Our best students, again, perform exceptionally well here too, although we must accept the criticism that even at the top, achievement could be higher still if the A-level curriculum was broader, which is why the new AS levels are being introduced so that students begin sixth form with 4 or 5 subjects before narrowing down. However, our biggest challenge, again, is not actually at the top. It's with the middle and the bottom third of achievers. For the middle third, opportunities to progress to worthwhile, vocationally-oriented higher education courses are too restricted, which is why we're looking to a further expansion of higher education, focusing in particular on new 2-year courses akin to US associate degrees to meet high skill needs in particular vocational areas. And with the bottom third, frankly, the situation is still pretty deplorable. Today, that's in 1999, there are still 160,000 16 to 18-year-olds, nearly 1 in 10 of the total, who are neither in education or training or have a job. Now, the New Deal is looking after some of the older ones, but those 16 to 18-year-olds, most of them left school with no GCSEs whatever, or practically none. A further 17% undertake no formal education or training, usually because their qualifications and motivation are not up to it. So a quarter of our school leavers have effectively given up on education and training, and they've often done so well before they've ever actually left school. No surprise, then, that our staying on rates in education and training are far below the European Union average. Now, the roots of this lie in the widespread failure, demotivation, and underperformance at school that I've described already. But incentives to stay on and the range and quality of post-16 education are also important, and we're addressing these too. We've just started, for example, with pilots for education maintenance allowances, which are cash allowances of up to £40 a week for students from lower income families who are engaged in worthwhile post-16 courses. If these make sufficient impact, we're ready to reduce such allowances nationwide as part of our commitment to student support to encourage participation and achievement. We are also promoting new arrangements for post-16 education and training to improve work-based training and provision in our further education colleges, which are a crucial but underappreciated part of the education system. So our vision is simple, then. It is to abolish the outdated notion of an education leaving age of 16, to make staying on, whether physically in a school or college or by combining work with study, perhaps through ICT, as common as success in literacy and numeracy at primary school. And by doing so, we hope to instill a habit of lifelong learning, giving each individual the capacity and flexibility to benefit from learning and training throughout life, particularly when it comes to changing jobs and updating skills. Universities also have a critical part to play in this learning society. I need hardly stress how important excellence and diversity are in higher education as in schools. The last government was right to dismantle the artificial barriers of title, which divided universities from polytechnics. The result has not been convergence and some identikit average, nor should it be. Universities develop their own missions according to their own strengths. And we will always be careful to target resources so as to secure best value and excellence, both in teaching and research. Government has a responsibility both to fund research adequately and to ensure that resources for university teaching and student support safeguard quality and open access. And we are mindful, and were mindful, of both obligations in our reforms to student finance and in our large extra investment in the research and science base. We will also continue to pay close attention to the pressures on universities. But I think today we can say that the future is as much in your hands as ours. I'm told that less than one third of Oxford's income now comes from the government's higher education funding councils. Universities, particularly the world leaders like Oxford, compete in an increasingly international market for research, staff, students, and innovation. You're at the threshold of this ICT revolution, which could transform the very idea of the university as a community of learning, as surely as ICT will transform learning in schools. In the knowledge economy, entrepreneurial universities will be as important as entrepreneurial businesses, the one fostering the other. Universities are, in fact, today, wealth creators in their own right, in the value they add through their teaching at home, in the revenue, commitment, and goodwill for the UK they generate from overseas students, a market we need to exploit as ambitiously as possible, and in their research and development, which is of incalculable impact to the economy at large. So we look to you and to other leading universities, not only as the guardians of traditions of humane learning on which your reputation depends, but also as one of our key global industries of the future, able to give the UK a decisive competitive advantage within Europe and beyond in the 21st century economy. This means government giving you the support that only we can provide, that is true, but it also means universities generating the maximum possible entrepreneurial drive on a national and international plane. Underpinning all that I've said this evening is a broader theme. A learning society does not just depend upon well-educated individuals. It requires learning institutions throughout society, and I don't just mean schools and colleges and universities. In the knowledge economy, every organisation, everyone, from the business to the community group, the hospital, the employment agency, government itself, has constantly to improve. To succeed, it must be open and receptive to change, to best practice at home and abroad, to competitive pressures, to new ways of working, to the new demands of customers and consumers. Organisations capable of reflecting systematically on what they do, lessons learned, evaluation, assessment, benchmarking against the best in the world, prepared to be radical where necessary in order to make change, and developing their staff accordingly, these organisations succeed. This is a challenge for business. In Silicon Valley, for example, companies are tested for their success in getting new knowledge onto the balance sheet, but it's no less a challenge for the public sector. The public sector has, for obvious reasons, been slow to put in place knowledge management systems so that, for example, local police forces can learn from international best practice, schools can learn from their counterparts overseas. But initiatives now such as the new College for School Leadership for school leaders, the Centre for Management and Policy Studies established right in the heart of Whitehall to disseminate best practice, are intended to counter this weakness. And here too, universities have a part to play with your extraordinary international perspective and sources of knowledge and research. I began with Mr. Gladstone and the fundamental failure in the 19th and 20th centuries to provide excellence for the many in education. Confronting our past is difficult and painful, particularly when the past is so recent. It's only 10 years since Kenneth Baker described moving from the Department of the Environment to the Department of Education. It was like moving from the manager's job at Arsenal to Charlton. You cross the river and drop two divisions. Now it is only one, and some of us might not take the same view of Arsenal. But all of us know that a nation whose government relegates education out of the Premier Division will end up relegated and everything else too. Our mission is not just to reverse that decline. It is to mobilise with all the strength we can the purpose and resolve of this generation to transform Britain into a learning society. A society where the learning habit empowers the many, not the few, where our top universities cease to be simply oases of opportunity for the fortunate few and become the apex of an educational pyramid that spans the whole of society. It can be done, and we have started to do it, but we will need a very great deal of will to see it through. Sometimes when people ask why I'm so passionate about education, I feel, got to be careful saying why you're so passionate about education, this great institution. It's a story, you know, of Harold Wilson when he went down to the Chatham dockyards in the course of the 1964 election and said to all the assembled people there and the workforce, he said, defence, vitally important. He said, why do I say defence is so important? And a voice from the crowd said, because you're in Chatham. However, I think I've said before that education is important, but let me explain why personally it is. And Eric Anderson, who's the master of a college here and who's was my housemaster at school, is in the audience this evening. It's always one of those things I have to get used to, is making speeches as Prime Minister in front of my old schoolmasters. It's a very difficult thing to do, as some of you may learn in due course. But I look back at my own educational opportunities, which were fantastic. And I know that I would not have had a hope of ever being Prime Minister or actually ever achieving very much in life without the advantages that education gave me. And I also meet, in my own constituency most of all, but seeing my own children at schools in London too, you meet young people of various ages, and in particular when you meet them in their late teens, and they are naturally clever and able, often witty and bright and all the rest of it, but they just haven't had the education they need to succeed. And you know that those children will never, ever really attain the full extent of their potential. And I feel, as someone who got the breaks in life, who was really lucky, that I have some understanding, at least, of how important that is. So when we talk about education as a priority for government, I think it's not enough for it to be a priority for government. I mean, we will make the changes in investment and reform as a government over the period of time for which we're elected. If we're elected again at the next election, I think we can complete the process of reform and investment we've made. As I say, we're two tough years, but the money will come in now. The reform is coming in. If we can keep this up and sustain it over a long period of time, I've no doubt at all that government will discharge its responsibility. But it can't be done something like this. It requires such a sense of national coherence and purpose. It can't actually be done unless the whole country, as it were, shares in that sense of partnership to get it done. And we, all of us here tonight in our different ways, have been lucky in getting that first-class education. And what we've got to do is commit ourselves as a country to give it to every single one of our citizens. Sure, people will always have different abilities. Sure, not everyone can be as bright as the next person. But I look at the stock of our young people in this country today, who are the future of this country, and I know we are squandering a vast potential that is there to be used for their benefit and for the benefit of the country. And I don't think there is any better ambition than to try and make this country the best educated nation in the Western world. A lot of the causes in politics that have been big in the 20th century have bitten the dust. And in the 21st century, the battles will be quite different in politics. But even though the battles of ideology are different, the noble causes are still there. They still exist. And there is no more noble cause than education of quality for all. And we should dedicate our nation to it. Thank you.